That is everybody back from breakout rooms. Okay. Welcome, everyone. Go around and say hi, starting with Franklin, Bob K, Paul, Nicole. And remind us where you are, Nicole.
I'm here in Portland, Oregon.
That's kind of unusual for us sometimes. You could be anywhere in the world. Well, cool. And Margaret, and where are you?
I'm in Oakland, California.
Okay, cool. And Marv, who's up in Vancouver, BC. And Tyler, who's up in Sook, BC. Susan, here in Portland. Jim, outside of Portland. Gathel, Portland. Drew, Beaverton.
Close enough.
Yeah, a suburb. Paula, in Ontario, Canada. Yes, and Alice, also in the general Portland area. Joan,
Glacier Park, Montana. Today.
Oh, you're in the RV.
Yes.
Glacier Park, huh?
Yes.
Oh, beautiful. Oh, all I've seen of Glacier is from the train. So I always go, that's so cool. Joan in Portland and Linda in Portland. So welcome. Oh, so let's see. Announcements, and if you are subscribed to our newsletter, you probably already know all of this stuff, but we have postponed our official Zendo reopening because the COVID situation in Oregon is as bad as it's ever been. My husband pointed out a good point, though. I haven't heard it mentioned in the news, but part of it is like, we didn't have it so bad before, right? So we don't have as many people who got it. And so anyway, it's hitting us now, unfortunately. So, but that's kind of indefinitely postponed, but I have good news that we do have the Zendo set up for Zoom. We tested it on Monday. So thanks to Bob and James, we've got a Zoom monitor and a camera and microphones and all this stuff. So we will be giving that a try starting Monday, which is the first day of our retreat. So Monday evening through Saturday morning is our August retreat. There's a full schedule and you can see it online. There's links in the newsletter as well. And you can obviously participate by Zoom. You can participate full-time, part-time. And if you are local and you are fully vaccinated and feel like taking this risk, there will be a small handful of us doing the session at the Zendo. And if, unfortunately, fortunately, we're going to try to keep it to a stable bunch. So we're limiting it to like no more than 10 people. It'll probably be fewer than that. And so it won't be open for just like we usually would have it where you could just drop by if you feel like it. You know, you kind of need to be registered first. So even if you do want to spend just, a couple evenings or something, then you would need to register for the session retreat. And otherwise you don't need to register, but if you want to express your intention to me, that is nice. And then I'll kind of expect that you'll be joining us at certain times. Let's see. Okay. Term student will be beginning in less than a month. I guess it's about 3 weeks away. It begins on Saturday, September 11th. And that is the opening retreat, and the closing retreat, I believe, is the end of November, very beginning of December. So between those times, then you commit to a set of vows, which you create for yourself. And we as the people who've signed up for the program, you know, we stay in touch and support one another in our intentions over the course of that time. So if you are interested in that program, I recommend it for people who've already been participating with us for a few months, because a lot of times you don't need additional vows, you know, in it, you don't need vows in addition to just trying to start to participate regularly. So it's nice addition to your regular practice. Any questions or other things I should mention? Okay. So today we are continuing with our the Book of Householder Koans, and we're studying Myokan. So we're kind of just skipping around and studying different chapters, and this is Myokai opening. So let me I have a copy of the verse on Google Docs. I'm pulling that up right now so I can share it with you when we read it. All right. Okay, so this is a brief introduction for set the tone. So a koan is a Zen teaching story. It's actually the record of an interaction. Classically, it's between a student and a teacher. These ones don't necessarily have that, but they're about an interaction that teaches something. There's some kind of spiritual challenge or obstacle or something that is presented, that is brought out by this interaction. And then we save these stories and we read them, we contemplate them, we wrestle with them and see what kind of quandary or obstacle in our own lives this reminds us of, awakens us to. So in Rinzai Zen, they formally study koans in a curriculum and stuff like that. But in Soto Zen, we often use koans often just as a teaching tool, but we also emphasize that they arise in everyday life. So that's one of the neat things about this book, is that, you know, a lot of times the traditional koans are like, you know, what is the sound of one hand clapping, or does a dog have Buddha nature, or something like that, where it is meant to point at something that is in our experience, but it's a little tougher to translate. And so these are stories drawn from modern students in modern lives. So it's a little easier for us to access the issue that is being presented. And yeah, so we have been, you know, sticking to this book for a while. I am another announcement is that next Tuesday we won't have a class because we'll be in the middle of retreat, but please join us just for sitting. So that we'll just be sitting, and then I think at some point, I don't have the schedule in front of me, but at some point in the evening, I'll be giving a short Dharma talk during Zazen. So you might want to tune in for that. So then next week, we won't have a class. The week after, I do have another one of these koans on the schedule. I am tempted to start using a different book, which just came out this week. Called You Are Still Here by Kyogen Carlson. So if anybody feels like looking that up on the web and pasting a link in the chat, you're welcome to. So this is a collection of teachings by one of my teachers. So my teacher is Gyokuko Carlson. Kyogen was her husband. He passed away about 5 years ago. So this is like a sweet opportunity to access his teachings and, you know, the kinds of teachings that really influence me that are part of our lineage. So I'm tempted to start using that book instead or as well. So Okay, so when we let's see, I'll hold on that part a little bit. So when I read the koan that I chose for this week, I realized it has something, it's not unrelated to the one that we did last week, which had to do is whose Myokan was the student's name, and the koan was Mom. And we talked about, like, so the story is like, you know, all her kids are like this demand, that demand, nonstop demand as soon as you wake up in the morning. And we just talked about the many demands of life and how we meet them and respond as authentically as possible. And this one is also has the interaction between a child and an adult and has kind of to do with demands, but it's a little different. So the classic form of a koan, which we will read the verse and the story. And the classic is, you know, there's the verse, there's the koan story, a short little story, and then there's a commentary. And in this book, they follow that same format. So I will share my screen while I read it. So I can't say that I really understand the relevance of the verse, but here we go. Mickey, Minnie, Popeye, and Donald Duck. Red shorts, white gloves, yellow shoes. Don't they always talk the same? Oh boy, that sure is swell. So the story is Myoki was giving a lecture to her fifth grade class. Too many snow days meant she had to hurry to finish her curriculum. The students weren't happy about this. Suddenly, out of the corner of her eye, Myoki saw her pupil, Steven, standing upright by his desk. He'd gotten a hold of her black sweater and was wearing it down over his thighs like a short dress, hands clasped against the side of his cheek, lips pursed, striking an enticing Minnie Mouse pose. He stared straight at her, all in the middle of class. Myoki had an opening. So, you can, oh, let me, I will paste this, this document into the chat. So if you want to pull it up yourself, to have a look at it. If you don't have the book, you can do that. So just a note about, you know, opening, that's kind of a Zen term for, you know, an awakening experience, but it doesn't have to be really far out and transcendent. It can mean just, you know, it's an insight, but not just an intellectual insight. We mean an insight that really, that causes a shift in your body, mind, and heart, and usually allows you to act a little differently from then on out. So our central koan question, whenever we have been studying one of these, is what is the spiritual challenge being presented here by this story? And as we've discussed in previous classes, a koan, a spiritual challenge, is not about how to change things external to your own body mind. That's an interesting subject for discussion, but that's not what it is about, right? So in this case, this story of Myoki is not about the best methods for discipline in a fifth grade class. This is about her experience and positive change may happen, but we can't control that. This is about our own body and mind, including our thoughts and feelings, our choices, our behavior, our speech. And this is the only realm in which we have choice. And I like to say not that we have choice as opposed to we have control, because I think we all know, like, that's questionable whether we have really, you know, control over our minds and hearts and bodies, but we have choices there. So working with something as a koan means we work on our own relationship to what is happening. What can we shift in our own body and mind that alleviates some of the tension or stress, regardless of what happens around us? So there's no right or wrong answer to what is the spiritual challenge being presented here in this koan or any koan. What spiritual challenge in your own direct experience does this evoke for you, remind you of? So it helps us to imagine our way into the koan story. What might Miyoki be feeling as she hurries to get through her curriculum? So this, what I'm imagining is this expectation about what she needs to cover in a set period of time, you know, comes from her bosses. It comes from the principal and the school board. And, you know, it comes from the powers that be have decided this is what needs to be covered. And she will be held accountable if that doesn't happen. And if she doesn't manage to teach the kids what it was they were supposed to learn in a given period of time, parents will probably complain. If she doesn't finish the lesson that she has planned for today, that will only make subsequent days busier and more stressful. So not to mention that as a teacher, presumably she wants to make sure her students learn everything they need to. So kind of imagine your way into this position. Let's say she's got 20 minutes left for this lecture to her fifth grade class. As we hear, kids are already, they already don't really like it. They're resisting how fast this is going. So I'm picturing she's also needing to monitor and keep disciplining small little points of resistance. You know, okay, no, put that away. Okay. look up at the front. So she's doing all of this. And then the class clown, Steven, you know, disrupts everything with his exploit. And he's managed to grab her sweater from behind the teacher's desk, which is, you know, weird and not okay anyway. And then honestly, he's wearing it pulled down like a dress and kind of does look like Minnie Mouse. But if Miyoki laughs and lets Steven off the hook, the class is likely to get excited. Everybody else is going to laugh. And you're probably not going to get anything done for the remainder of the 20 minutes. And it would be irresponsible of Miyoki as a teacher to just say, oh, to heck with the curriculum. Let's just have fun. On the other hand, to respond to Stephen with his rambunctiousness and his energy and creativity, which you kind of sympathize with, that doesn't seem quite right either. So at this moment, that moment, the moment of the koan, what is Miyoki likely to be feeling? So I will share my screen again, because I figured we could do a little bit of a brainstorm about this. So what happens? What is Miyoki probably experiencing as this kid disrupts her class? What thoughts or feelings arise? What happens in her body? You know, what happens to you when you're in a similar situation? Go ahead and unmute yourself and just chime in.
I'm guessing she's very annoyed and feeling tight in her body because she's not quite sure what to do, but she's definitely annoyed and frustrated because she doesn't quite know what to do.
Linda.
I would be feeling a little bit like I was caught by surprise.
Mm.
But I would also want to laugh, and I would be trying to stifle that so that the kids didn't see that I was trying to laugh.
Yeah. Franklin.
So I think this is a really interesting one, because I think up to the point of the kid showing off, she's probably super stressed and just feeling the pressure of the anxiety of getting all this work done. And then there's this transition point where the kid is being goofy. And so it's kind of like she's maybe just struck by the absurdity of everything, of all of it, right? Maybe. Yeah.
Alice.
I would think that this is a manifestation of what everyone's feeling. So it's kind of, I don't know, if I saw that, I wouldn't be caught by surprise, especially if I'm feeling the same way. Like, you know, like there's pressure and there's a pressure cooker. So of course some pressure is going to be let out. And this is how it goes.
So in that sense, like in a way, Miyoki and her students are all feeling that.
And it's just manifesting as that.
I could imagine there being some anger, you know, anger that you might try to restrain, because it's, you know, just a kid and you're a teacher, whatever, but, you know, I'm trying to get through this lesson, and now Nicole.
So I don't know if anyone else noticed, but when you were telling this story, my 9-year-old came out with a costume on and was just trying to get my attention and distracting me. And I was feeling disrespected because I had specifically asked for the opportunity to have this time for myself. And I can imagine the teacher was maybe feeling a little disrespected as well.
Yeah, and I don't know, I guess maybe also, I mean, I'm just going to imagine myself feeling rather resentful in kind of a general kind of way, just resentful of being in that situation where, you know, now you have this stress and this pressure, and you're having to put the kids in this situation, and now you have to like fight it. Tyler.
I think that's kind of along what I was thinking. Just like, I feel like she'd probably feel very torn, because you had this, I mean, sitting, what was it, grade 5 kids? Like lecturing grade 5 kids is probably not what the average teacher wants to do with grade 5 kids, right? And but you do have this curriculum you have to meet. You have these expectations. But really, I think a lot of teachers, they did this because they love children. They want to have fun with them. And then just be like, just torn between like, yeah, like maybe these kids just need a little bit of time to be goofy, but I've got this other big thing weighing on me. And that's like how do you balance those two things?
Yeah, I could see feeling kind of resentful for being put in that position that like, I wanted to be a teacher, but now I got the curriculum, and now Gethel.
Well, one possibility is that she realizes the absurdity of the moment and her so incredible, her realizing that her own actions are absurd. I mean, we really don't know her relationship with this person. Is he the class clown? Is he one of her best students? But it's possible that she just realizes in that moment that her situation is absurd. There's really no reason to get so worked up in it. Mm. In a sense, he's telling her to enjoy, lighten up.
Yeah. Let me see. I will stop sharing that. And then to explore more than what is the spiritual component of this quandary. I mean, it's something that we can relate to, but kind of what more is going on here. So I was just reflecting on this when we experience any moments in our lives of tension or stress, difficulty, reactivity, anxiety, fear, whatever. It's hard to generalize what are all those things, but just points of tightness. Sometimes it's outright negative, right? But sometimes it's not quite that bad. It's just, these things aren't flowing the way that, ideally they are, should, or we want them to. And so this is an opportunity from a Zen perspective, no matter, what kind of situation we're talking about, whether we think it's a justified situation, it's really about other people's treatment of us or whatever, we have an opportunity here, but not as we usually do, just to criticize ourselves. Because I could imagine being in Miyoki's situation and just thinking, oh, I wish I could be more patient and understanding and, just kind of self-criticizing about this point of tension or this obstacle is pointing to a deficiency in myself. But that's not what this kind of koan examination is. It's asking what's really going on here. What aspect of our sense of ourselves is coming into conflict with reality? How are we making the situation worse in ways that we don't have to? Or what are we afraid of happening? So at the base of all koans, from the Zen point of view, is a fundamental misunderstanding about the true nature of self and reality. If it's a fear of death, it's a grasping for control, it's a befuddlement in the face of interruption. It all ties back to this. So by studying these challenges, then, even they're just kind of symptoms of our lack of complete understanding, then we can use these as entry points into learning. So that's the koans are often called the gateless gate, that we can use them. So in this chapter, the authors end up, who essentially wrote this koan, they focus on our sense of time, but I'd like to focus more on the concept of interruption, which is related to our sense of time. So we have a plan for this hour. We have a plan for this day, plan for this week, a plan for this year, plan for our lives, more or less. So we have an idea of how we'd like things to go, how we're trying to get things to go. Even if we're relatively laid back, you know, we make these plans, or sometimes it's how they need to go, right? And these are almost like pre-narratives. I'm thinking those pre-narratives. So we're very familiar with, you know, having a narrative about who we are and about our past and, you know, needing to kind of loosen our grasp on those. But in a way, these are narratives about the future. And plans, of course, are natural and necessary. We wouldn't get anything done if we didn't make plans. We'd never create anything or make any progress or be able to like collaborate with other people. But what happens when our plans get interrupted? When our pre-narrative does not unfold as we thought, or it unfolds in a way we never wanted it to unfold? So what happens when our child is born with a disability, or our beloved spouse gets taken away from us way too young? That was not part of the plan. Or our health issues mean that we can't live the life that we really want to live. What happens when the peace and prosperity of our lives is threatened by climate change? This is not, that was not going to be part of my narrative. What happens when the government that we live under gets overthrown and we find ourselves part of an oppressed class with few freedoms, which is the case, I think Gathel, that's a leftover hand, isn't it, Gathel? Or did you have something you wanted to say?
Nope, don't need it.
Okay.
Didn't go down.
All right, I'll lower it for you. There we go. Yeah, so what happens when our plans get interrupted? Whether this is, you know, this obviously can be much more minor than what I'm talking about. You know, our plan for teaching this fifth grade class has been interrupted. Our plan to go get our grocery shopping done has been interrupted because we got this phone call, or, you know, we plan to go on a trip, but then the car broke down or whatever. So it can be all the way from just, you know, that kind of small momentary interruption to really big interruptions in our lives. So I'm just going to do another little brainstorm here of why do interruptions bug us so much? If we want to respond skillfully, if we want to take it in stride without it freaking us out too much, what do we have to do internally within our own body and mind? Linda.
Well, depending on how serious or important the situation is, I can become very attached to the way I thought something should be in my life that was a disappointment, very attached to having things go a certain way. And if I loosen my emotional grip on those things, whatever it may be, then I can suffer less over the loss of something not going the way I wanted to. Now, that said, it's not always so easy to do that. For example, a year ago this week, my husband had a stroke, and I didn't know if he was going to live or die. And when he had the stroke, he was only 52 years old. So things went a lot better than I thought they would. He's out playing golf right now, but we didn't know, you know, and it was touch and go for a while. And so then I always have to have in the back of my mind that things can change in a moment, and that's life. And then hopefully I'll react in a way that moves me and those around me forward in a good direction.
Thank you for sharing. Paula?
I find if I'm confronted with something like this, Stephen with the sweater on, I can imagine in some instances too, how I respond to the situation would depend on how I'm doing in that moment. But when I am confronted with things that seem to be going not according to plan, I've tried to cultivate a sense of letting go, of dropping into my body and staying with an awareness of how my body feels out of curiosity. So it might feel horrible, it might feel okay, and then I try to be have an awareness of letting go of thinking that horrible is bad, that horrible is unwanted. So I try to stay with that. And then I try to cultivate a sense of curiosity that, well, this isn't how I planned, but maybe it'll, not maybe, but it will be okay. Like, this isn't the way I thought things would go, but I cultivate a sense of, let's see what happens. Of maybe it'll be better. Maybe it will be okay either way. Whatever happens will be okay either way. And just let go and cultivate a sense of curiosity so that if I'm not curious, then I can't learn from the situation. I'll just complain about it. But maybe there is a real teaching in that situation. But if I'm not curious about it, I won't even see that there could be a teaching, that there could be an opportunity for learning if I'm just dour about why didn't it work out the way I wanted to. That's what I try to do.
And can you say something about, and I think Linda mentioned this too, of just kind of whatever happens will be okay, which is, I think, a really profound, you know, that is a koan in and of itself. You know?
I had to learn that with my work with horses. If I'm going into a situation that could be dangerous, I have to say, whatever happens will be okay, and I will be okay. I am not going to try to make Forrest a 1,000-pound animal to do something that he or she doesn't want to do. It's not my job.
So what do you mean by being okay? Because, you know,
what do we mean by that? That's a good question. Yeah. That's a good question. So to be specific, with the situation with horses, I could get fired. I could maybe not finish my job trimming feet. I might finish my job trimming feet. Whatever, I'm okay. And I will physically not get hurt. In that situation, I will not put myself in a situation where I'll get hurt. So I would say to the owner or the trainer, this animal, this horse needs more time and more training, or we need to involve a veterinarian if they need immediate hoof care for health reasons, for sedation. But I'll speak my truth. And whatever the outcome, whether it's successful in a business term for me or not successful, will be okay. It's okay. It's all right.
So it sounds like a kind of faith in your capacity to respond.
Yeah.
Just.
And if I don't see that things will be okay, then I can't learn from them. If I get so emotionally caught up and I have to accomplish this, then I will not see that there are other opportunities to learn.
Thank you. Alice.
I really liked Paula's response because I think there's a lot to be learned from what she said. To corroborate a little bit further, I think it helps to have an openness of discovery for each moment that changes. I mean, I can extrapolate this to many parts of our lives. For mine, living in an RV, everything breaks. Like, things leak, things have accidents. The other day, our AC didn't work, and it happened to be 100 degrees outside. We had that heat dome in the Northwest, you know, and I had to sleep in 90 degrees, you know. And at first, I was scared that gosh, this would be a horrible night. But then I was just like, all right, let's see how I acclimate to it. I acclimated just fine. I mean, not to say that that wasn't unpleasant, but, you know, I mean, let's talk about COVID as our biggest interruption in 2019, right? That was a huge interruption to our lives. And I'm sure a lot of us could still be freaking out about it. You know, we have to look into how we dealt with the situation when we had to lock down and whatnot. Personally, for me, it was a combination of being frightened, but also, okay, reality is changing. Let's see what this reality is going to bring. Things may not be okay. Things may be a bit dangerous, but let's see how we discover how to survive in the next moment. Maybe it's a faith, an inward faith that that I'll figure it out, or we'll figure it out, maybe.
Tyler, I muted myself. Like, Tyler,
that was a dramatic
pause. You want to go, Tyler?
You're just like, this is kind of, I guess, Alistair, going a bit in this direction near the end. Ever since I've been with my partner, if something didn't go according to plan, she's always been like, well, it wasn't meant to be. And that always drove me nuts for the longest time, because I was like, I was never a big believer in faith, like, or not faith, fate. Like, I was never but like, the more I heard it, the more I was like, right. Cause if that was something, if that was a path I was supposed to be on, you know, knowing that I'm doing my best, I'm not letting go of responsibility. It was just, if it didn't go that way, that's just not how the way it was supposed to go. And it took me a long time to accept that. And, but now when these things happen, we kind of look at each other like, oh, I guess that wasn't meant to be. And it's probably not for every situation, you know, like if you don't hit your curriculum and your boss is like, you didn't hit your curriculum, and you're like, meh, wasn't meant to be. Like, that might not swing it with them. But another thing I used to, when we first got like Google Maps, where I had enough data where I could drive and my map would tell me where to go in my car, I used to find it really fun to go away from where the map was telling you to go. And then watch it be like recalibrate. And then it would give you like a new route. And like, we're like, tell you. And so sometimes when things aren't going the way I plan, I think of like that map recalibrating in my head and being like recalibrating. And just like, okay, now we're off in this direction. And it doesn't always stop the frustration, but that's minorly entertaining for me.
I like it. Susan. Oh, you're still muted.
I was saying, I kept putting up the wrong hand and it would disappear. I put up the clapping hand until I saw that one. So what, a few weeks ago, you mentioned about you like to be in control. And I thought, that's strange. And I thought, no, that's me. If things don't go the way I have them planned, I get upset. I like things controlled. And so now that I've become aware of it, which is similar to what this is, I think I'm better. And usually when things don't go, it's because someone's interrupting me, you know, my daughter needs something or somebody else needs something. And so I've said, I just told myself, I don't always need to be in control. You know, other people have needs too. It's not all about me. So I'm getting a little tiny bit better.
I like it. And I'm curious about this, this sense of everything being okay. It, because, I mean, sometimes, you know, it's kind of literal, right? We say, you know, maybe I'll lose that investment, but I've got a bunch of other savings. You know, like it's recognizing like we're kind of physically, literally going to be okay. But I think there's a deeper sense of being okay that we can, you know, maybe not always have access to, but and it's, you know, it's, and in a way, like the question of what okay means, if we're divorcing it from, you know, literal, physical, financial, whatever, it almost points to like, what does it mean? It's not going to be okay. Like, what are we most afraid of? And I mean, honestly, I think we have different versions of this, right? Our koans take different shapes depending on who we are as people. But ultimately, it can be a fear of death, a fear of annihilation, which is like, you know, for those of us, I would imagine everybody likes to be in control to some extent. Like we follow that along, right? Like if I don't complete this curriculum, then, you know, my job might be in danger. And if I lose my job, then I'm going to run out of money and I'm going to lose my house and I'm going to end up on the street and I'm going to like, you know, and it kind of all points to like disaster, you know, it points to loss, it points to, you know, discomfort, it points to humiliation, it, you know, points to these disastrous things that what we can get really wound up about. And it's interesting how spiritual practice, and it doesn't have to be formal, like only through Buddhism can you achieve this, right? We find this in different ways, but what about getting to a sense that it's going to be okay, even if those things happen? What is okay? And what is not okay? Looks like Marv, are you trying to, you go, just go ahead and unmute yourself.
Thank you. What you were saying before, I got the feeling that part of the problem is when we're planning something, we expect it to go our way. We are, in a sense, reifying the future. We're making it a solid thing when really it's fluid. So by the same token, to go around and say, well, whatever happens, it will be okay, you're doing the same thing. you're making a solid future. So maybe it's better to say it is okay right now. And that's sort of what you said in your last podcast. Yeah. There is no present, there is no past, there is no future, and right now is okay.
I think for me, I think that is true, but there's a way that you can, and I think people have been reflecting this in what they've been saying. Think of the best way to put it. I can have faith that no matter what happens, there will be a right now. When you are right here and we're looking into the future about all the terrible things that could happen, it's a fallacy in a way, right? The future doesn't exist. Probably not going to turn out the way we expect anyway. But if we go down that road, I love the image of the recalibrating map, right? Whatever happens, there we will be. And we will do our best. And we will have the tools of practice. And maybe we'll be miserable. And maybe we'll be happy. And I don't know. It's like, that's okay in the sense that we can't do anything more than that, and we don't have to. It's almost like a sense that we're obligated to keep this shit under control. And it's like, you know, like people were saying, like, I'm not always in control. And that, like, so it really has to do with, once again, it's our sense of self, right? It has to, if we look underneath these anxieties and concerns, it has to do with our sense of self. Me, I will suffer. I will fail. I need this to happen. And when we're able to let the self, that reified self, fall off, fade away, then it's just, yeah, we're living this unfolding. We'll see. And in that sense, like, even, I mean, it's not that things are okay necessarily literally, right? They could really suck. But they can suck and be okay. Such a strange thing. Paula.
I think I resonated, Domio, when you said about the tools of practice, and that when things are miserable, they can be okay because the tools of practice over years and years and years of practice, whatever it is, has, whatever we're experiencing, has meaning. Mm. That there's meaning in what's happening to us, whether we like what's happening or don't like what's happening, or we like our response or we don't like our response. This is my cat. There's meaning. It has meaning, and we can find meaning. But that's transitory too. It's just as fleeting as the breath, as everything else, right?
Yeah. And I guess I think about this too in terms of it's hard to let go of our hopes and our plans when that becomes obvious that, like, okay, well, that's not how it's going to go. it's hard to let go of that. But there can be, and a number of people who've mentioned this said, you know, we may experience an interruption in our plans that we would have, you know, if we could have prevented it, we would have, right? It's not like we wanted that. We're not, if we could undo it, we would. But here it is. And people are talking about how you don't know how it's going to turn out. It's a new map now, right? It's a new journey. And it's not going to be all bad. Whatever the new journey is, it's not going to be all bad. And I don't know, for some reason, I'm just thinking of this this book that I read when I had the wonderful opportunity many years ago to do a tourist trip to South Africa with my husband through his work. And I did a bunch of reading about South Africa on the way, and I, you know, learned about their townships, which are, you know, largely Black people, and, you know, incredible poverty and basically, you know, metal shacks, just, you know, miles and miles, hundreds of square miles of metal shacks with the barest, you know, barest of services. You're lucky if you have electricity, kind of thing. And there was a story of this guy, this white guy who went and lived in the townships for, I don't know, a year or something like that, a substantial amount of time. And he just wrote this book about his experiences. And I was just so struck by, you know, he didn't pull any punches about how difficult it was, you know, crime ridden, you know, all kinds of stuff. But like, it also was the warmest place that he had ever lived. It was also the place with the most community and the most generosity. People just, do you need something? Do you need some shelter? Do you want some of my beer? It was just, and I guess that just really struck me, because we have this imagination of how, you know, if things don't go according to my plan, they will just be a disaster. But, you know, that's not always so. There's other things we discover, other. Any last thoughts? All right. Well, thank you everyone for your thoughtful participation, teaching one another. I'll say our closing verse. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. And I forgot my bearing witness at the beginning of class. And so I would also like to bear witness to the experience of the people in Afghanistan. And bearing witness means simply opening our hearts and minds to their experience, to the suffering and the fear, without worrying about whether we know what to do about it or who's to blame or whatever. Because when we think about those things, we usually shut off our heart because we don't know the answer. So we just open to that reality and wish for peace and liberation and freedom for people, all Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, maha sattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Tomio.
Thank you.
Good night.